This week on the Writer's Detective Bureau, 20 Books Vegas, POIs and unsubs, and wiretap technicalities.
I'm Adam Richardson, and this is the Writer's Detective Bureau.
Welcome to episode number 68 of the Writer's Detective Bureau, the podcast dedicated to helping authors and screenwriters write professional quality, crime-related fiction. And this week, I'm talking about the 20 Books Vegas Conference and answering your questions about police acronyms and slang like POI and unsub, as well as the more technical side of setting up a wiretap investigation. But first, I need to thank Gold Shield patrons Deborah Dunbar from DeborahDunbar.com, CC Jameson from CCJameson.com, Larry Keaton, Vicky Tharp of VickyTharp.com, Chris Ann, Larry Darter, Natalie Borelli of NatalieBorelli.com, and Craig Kingsman of CraigKingsman.com for their support. I also want to send a huge thank you to my Coffee Club patrons, both my brand new Coffee Club members and those of you that have been supporting me for months and even over a year now. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. You can find links to all of the writers supporting this episode in the show notes at writersdetective.com/68. To learn about setting up your own Patreon account for your author business or to support the show for as little as $2 a month, visit writersdetective.com/Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. If you hear some extra rasp in my voice this week, it's likely because I just got home from 20 Books Vegas. Whiskey, cigars, and speaking on the police procedural panel took their toll on my throat, but they were all of it was an absolute blast. Patrick O'Donnell, author of the book Cops and Writers, moderated the panel, and we were joined by author and former LAPD detective Paul Bishop, who is a master at interview and interrogation, as well as Scott Moon, who is not only an author and police sergeant, but is also one of the hosts of the Keystroke Medium podcast. So definitely check that one out as well. The highlight of the entire conference, though, was getting to meet so many of you. I still find it very surreal that you are really out there listening to me talking to this microphone in my home office. So for those of you that came up to say hello, thank you so much. There were a lot of highlights, like drinking whiskey and beer on Mark Dawson's dime. Thank you, Mark. Not that you're listening. And hanging out every night with my new best buddy, Patrick O'Donnell. Now, we were already friends online and through the telephone, but we are definitely drinking and cigar-smoking buddies for real now. And by the way, Patrick, well, so I should let you guys know that on Patrick's way home, that bastard won $1,000 on a video poker machine at the airport. Nobody wins at the airport. I know you're listening, Patrick. You are buying the next steak dinner next year. Seriously, if that isn't a sign that you are in the right place doing the right thing, and by that I mean heading into retirement in a matter of weeks and getting more writing done, then I don't know what is. You deserve it, buddy. Okay, so I can't stop talking about 20 books because it was overwhelming. I mean, it was overwhelmingly awesome, but it was a lot to process. Being only 5 or 6 hours from Vegas, depending on traffic, the drive home was the perfect way to decompress and think about the entire weekend. You may, since we're just kind of getting to know one another through this like magic of the podcast thing, I guess I should explain that I'm an introvert, what Myers-Briggs calls an INFP or an INFPA, depending on what online test you take. But I'm an introvert that has learned how to put on the extroverted hat or helmet when needed. I wear more helmets than hats these days. But you might be surprised to learn just how many cops are actually introverts, which I think plays more into that gruff public exterior that many cops have than most people realize. So keep that in mind for your character creation. But anyway, the conference, 20 Books Vegas was amazing, especially for introverts. I've been to a ton of conferences and trainings over the last 2 decades, probably more than most pharmaceutical salespeople. And there have only been a handful that would classify as amazing. 20 Books Vegas was one of them. 20 Books Vegas is the main conference for the 20 Books to 50K group, a conference of self-published authors that are there to learn how to grow their self-publishing author business, meeting other self-published authors that are making 5, 6, and even 7-figure incomes. Man, I mean, this is not snake oil salesmanship. None of the phony get off your feet and dance MLM motivation musical conference kind of stuff. No one was selling you on anything, but the power of you. A lot of hard work and some pretty tactical and practical knowledge. This conference was unlike any other because everyone there, we were all compatriots, not competitors. And even this year's conference theme was clearly stated: a rising tide lifts all boats. But like any mission statement, it's easy to pay lip service to something and harder for it to be taken seriously. But that's what makes this group so different. Everyone is nice. I think the rule is actually don't be a dick or dickette. Pardon, there's a reason why I have the explicit language tagged. Everyone is welcoming. Everyone is supportive. The sessions were not sales pitches or egos being inflated and stroked. They were all about sharing knowledge of what works and learning how to improve what you're doing with your author business. That's it. The event was held at the Samstown Casino, an old school Las Vegas casino that is miles away from the Strip. And despite it being a step back to yesteryear, well, the rooms were big and renovated, but the staff, man, the staff at Samstown are the nicest people I've ever encountered in a casino, which is saying something because I've been to a lot of casinos around the world. The front desk folks at Samstown and even the overworked bartender at the open bar that Mark Dawson paid for were all smiles and welcoming. We even talked to a casino employee that got excited about the conference when he learned that it was all about being a self-published author because he too was self-publishing a sci-fi book. 2 years ago, this conference had 300 attendees. This year, it was over 1,000. Next year, they're expecting to have 1,500 attend. If you are feeling the loneliness of authorhood, especially if you're surrounded by family, friends, or coworkers that don't understand what your goals and dreams are for your writing, then trust me when I say that you will find your tribe at 20 Books. I've never seen so many strangers get invited to join a group for a meal or a drink in the bar. So many authors came to this conference all on their own and left with an entire group of new friends. I know I certainly did. And those of you that are listening, thank you so much for hanging out and making this an amazing week for me. I really appreciate you guys. There are only three things that will change who you are over the next 5 years: the books you've read, the people you've met, and the traveling you've done. Tick off all three of those by joining me and over 1,000 other awesome writers at 20 Books Vegas next November to get a head start on the next 5 years. Annie Rogers asked this question in the Facebook group. Keyword, cop lingo. Hi guys, quick question. Do cops generally use an acronym or a slang term for person of interest? POI or something else? Thanks. As my drinking and cigar buddy Patrick O'Donnell correctly answered in the Facebook group, the slang and acronyms will vary by department for almost everything in police work. When Patrick and I were smoking cigars at 20 Books Vegas a few days ago, he said something about dealing with POST in Wisconsin, P-O-S-T. Where Patrick works, POST stands for Police Officer Support Team, which is a peer support group for police officers experiencing PTSD-type issues at home or work. In California, though, POST is the Commission on Peace Officer Standards and Training. Every California Police Academy and most law enforcement training courses in California are certified by POST. So even the same acronyms will have different meanings from state to state. Now, POIs, or Persons of Interest, is a pretty common acronym or term across the U.S., but it seems to have garnered more pop culture usage thanks to a few primetime TV shows. Where I work, we do use POI as an acronym, primarily because POI is one of the ways of classifying a person in the report writing software that my department uses. So RP, or REP, often stands for reporting party. REP is the code that some software uses, others will use RP, but you'll hear the term RP or the abbreviation RP used on the police radio constantly in California, or at least at most departments in California and many more around the country. So if the old show Adam 12 were recording their famous TV intro today, it would be more likely contact the RP rather than the old see the man. I probably lost a whole generation of listeners with that comment right there, or that reference. But anyway, back to POI. While this may not be the case with every department, we use POI for a very particular purpose in our reports. A POI, a person of interest, is someone we can't quite call a suspect, but there's something about that person that makes them more than just a witness. It's kind of an in-between label, which, I guess looking at it anecdotally from a fiction author's perspective, might one day be a clue from one present-day detective to a future detective looking back on what may be a cold case. I guess that makes sense, a cold case in the future. So if I write POI, some detective may one day pick up on the fact that I thought there was something about this dude worth looking into further. And equally as often as not, a POI in the first report becomes a suspect in a subsequent follow-up report. Remember on previous episodes when I explained that major investigations like murders aren't just one report, but dozens of reports filed under a main case number? So you may have an initial offense report where the guy may be listed as a witness. Then in a subsequent interview, another officer or detective may think there's more to this guy's story. And in that follow-up report, they may list him as a POI. And then when the detectives figure out he really is involved, he might be listed as a suspect in yet a later follow-up report. So the status of witness, POI, or suspect can change based upon the chronology of the investigation and what the facts reveal. And those reports are going to reflect that. All that to say, a POI does not necessarily mean the same thing as suspect. And while we're on the topic, there's one TV show that refers to unidentified people, whether it's a witness, a POI, or a suspect, as unsub. The way it's used, I'm not sure which show it is, but the way it's used drives me nuts because it makes little sense. But that said, the term unsub really is used. But let me explain how and why and where the term unsub actually comes from. First of all, it is a federal law enforcement term. I've never heard unsub used at a local law enforcement agency, but I've heard unsub at the FBI and at the DEA, and I've heard it in a particular room at each of those agencies. Any guess as to which room that would be? The wire room. Unsub is usually followed by a number, like unsub 1 or unsub 7, and it's used to track the different unidentified subjects, or more specifically, unidentified voices, on a telephonic intercept, more commonly known as a telephone wiretap. So when your identified suspect calls another number, if the wire monitor doesn't know who that other person is, then they give him or her an unsub number. So your suspect calls me and I just say hello and we talk. Then I'll be listed as an unsub until they figure out my name and associate my name with my voice. And that can be accomplished in a number of ways, like using a court order on my phone service provider to find out who's listed on the bill, or even something as simple as hearing the suspect refer to me by name. So if you're the agent working this case, let's say you go a few days or weeks before figuring out that unsub 1 is actually Adam Richardson. Any call that is pertinent to the investigation is going to be transcribed. And if you have weeks worth of transcripts, simply doing the find and replace function in the transcription program makes it easy to find unsub 1 and replace it with the proper name, Adam Richardson. So in my experience, the only ones referring to people as unsubs are those working as monitors in a wire room, which segues us nicely into this week's next question. Nupur Tustin asked this in the Facebook group, keyword, cell phone wiretapping. How exactly does this work from a technical rather than a probable cause standpoint? Once law enforcement has court approval to wiretap a cell phone, are they simply relying on the phone company to record conversations and send them over? Is there anything law enforcement needs to do, or does, as for instance when Boston feds tapped underboss Gennaro Angiulo's headquarters in the 1970s? And finally, can both sides of the conversation be heard? Any and all answers appreciated. Many thanks. Well, the technical side of things has changed drastically since I started as a detective, but rather than rehash the rough old days when it comes to technology, here's the basic how it's done setup without revealing anything I shouldn't. Once the law enforcement officer has a signed court order for a telephonic communications intercept, they contact the phone company that provides the service for the target telephone, which is what we'd call the bad guy's cell phone or home phone. The law enforcement agency then has to make a pretty hefty payment to the phone company, and I'm talking several $1,000s per telephone line being intercepted, which pays for the phone company to make an electronic connection to the law enforcement agency's wire room. Without getting too technical, that connection is essentially like an encrypted internet connection directly to the phone company. Then, as soon as a phone call is made, the computer screen in the wire room comes to life and the live audio starts playing. It's the job of the monitor, and by that I mean the person monitoring the phone call, to determine whether this is a pertinent call or whether it's a call that's protected by privacy or a privilege. So if your bad guy calls his lawyer, the monitor can't record or listen to that call. Now, that said, the monitor can still click back in and listen to that call every few minutes to make sure it's still a privileged call, because we know how clever some of our suspects are. And if I know the feds can't listen to me talk to my lawyer, you can bet I'd pay my lawyer extra money to make a quick three-way phone call to someone I don't want the feds hearing me talk to. So the monitor is allowed to do spot checks. To answer your next question, Nupur, yes, since we are connecting directly to the phone company system, we hear the phone call just like anyone else that's on the call. So we would hear everybody that's talking. But as for your question about tapping the mob's headquarters in Boston during the late 70s, it's important to point out that there is a big difference between a telephonic intercept, that telephone wiretap we were talking about, and planting a bug. A microphone in a specific location to pick up conversations. I know this question was more about the technical and not the legal side of wiretaps, but whether you can plant a bug in someone's building depends on your legal authority. In the state of California, where I work, we cannot legally do that under California law. So I can write a state-level telephonic intercept order for the telephone wiretap, but there are no provisions in the law under state law for California for an area bug. Federal agencies, on the other hand, can write both types of wiretap orders. And a federal telephonic wiretap order is often referred to as a Title III. So that's some slang, going back to our last question, that you may have your characters use. So as an example for some dialogue using Title III in a sentence, the FBI is up on a Title III for some new wannabe mafia group, so I'm going to be on surveillance with them all night. Technically, Title III is only a federal wiretap, not a state wiretap, but I've heard cops incorrectly use Title III as slang for any wiretap. And for you research rabbit hole hunters, Title III is actually Title III of the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968, also known as the Wiretap Act, which established the procedures for obtaining warrants to authorize wiretapping by government officials. Which begs the history question, what did the cops do before 1968? Having worked a cold case from 1964, I actually got to see this firsthand. Prior to Title III, all the detective had to do was draft a one-page memo to the phone company, which back then was Bell Telephone in most places, or Ma Bell, as many called it, asking them to listen in on phone calls of a suspect's phone number and take notes as to what was said. See, this was back in the era of operators physically connecting phone calls by plugging cords from one jack to another, literally operating the phone system, hence the term operator. And she could listen in to any call coming across her switchboard, and if a wiretap memo was in place, she'd be sitting there taking notes on the call. Thank you so much for listening this week. It was great getting to meet so many of you at 20 Books Vegas. Now, you do not have to be a published author. Your book doesn't need to be out for you to send me a question. You just have to go to writersdetective.com/podcast and fill out the form. We are halfway through NaNoWriMo 2019, and my Gold Shield patrons will be getting another live Q&A session this week. So keep your eyes out for a message from me on Patreon with the specific date and time for the next one. And in fact, if you're one of my patrons, be sure to download the Patreon app on your phone to get a push notification the next time I go live. Thanks again for listening. Have a great week and write well.